From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Today, the House Judiciary Committee is hearing testimony on police brutality and racial profiling. It's the same week that House Democrats introduced sweeping reforms like banning police chokeholds, ending no-knock warrants for drug searches, and forcing states to collect data on police misconduct.
Philonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, who died under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, a death that touched off international outrage, spoke at today's hearing.
When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to for your whole life, die begging for his mom, I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Stop the pain. Stop us from being tired. George called for help, and he was ignored. Please listen to the call I'm making to you now, to the calls of our family and the calls ringing out the streets across the world. People of all backgrounds, genders, and races have come together to demand change. Honor them. Honor George.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. Kelsey, Philonis Floyd, very powerful, broke down in tears. And just one of several witnesses today, most called by Democrats. So what else did you hear?
I think that we heard one of the more moving moments from Floyd's testimony there. He was very clearly emotional after having, you know, the funeral was just yesterday. I think one of the theme that we heard across the witnesses from both parties is that there was an acknowledgement that the death of George Floyd was wrong and horrifying and that reforms are necessary. But there was not a lot of agreement or commitment about the right way to go about seeking those reforms. I will say that it was very interesting also to listen to one of the Republican witnesses. Her brother was a federal officer who died near the protests in Oakland, California. And she said that she empathized with the family of George Floyd, and she called for the same kind of justice for her brother. She was called by Republicans. She was a former Republican congressional candidate in California. So there was shared horror at the death of George Floyd, but this is not yet quite at a point where there's an agreement about what to do about it.
Well, it's striking to see Democrats and Republicans have different lists of possible law enforcement reform. You put them next to each other, they're different. And as we heard from Tanya, Democrats have on their list banning chokeholds. Republicans don't. Here's Representative Karen Bass, a Democrat, talking about national standards for police.
It should never be that you can do a chokehold in one city and not in another. There should be basic standards. There should be basic accreditation. There should be continuing education, just as there are in so many other professions.
Kelsey, what else are Democrats proposing?
Well, Democrats have a very extensive bill. They're talking, aside from just the chokeholds, they want to ban what is known as qualified immunity. It gives it has been used by police officers to so that they would be immune from trials, essentially from civil prosecutions. That is something that has been controversial. I will say that the issue of chokeholds has not been completely litigated between Democrats and Republicans. There is some openness among Republicans to consider a ban, but they are also talking about de-escalation, ways to lessen potential for chokeholds. There's a feeling among Republicans that they do not want to constrain the local police. So what is possible here, and something that the Republican staff has raised with me, is that there's a possibility that outside of the bill Democrats have proposed, there could be additional separate bipartisan negotiations and talks. We do know that Republicans in the Senate are working on their own proposals, which we may see in the coming days.
Well, and it could be said that Republicans are using calls to defund police as evidence that Democrats are weak on crime. Here's the Judiciary Committee ranking member, the Republican Jim Jordan.
It is pure insanity to defund the police. And the fact that my Democrat colleagues won't speak out against this crazy policy is just that frightening.
We're hoping to speak to Representative Jordan tomorrow. But meanwhile, Democrats have spoken out against defunding the police. It's something protesters are calling for. Representative Bass called it a distraction. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia said the idea is crazy. So where does this debate go? Are they just talking past each other?
Well, it is interesting to watch Democrats figure out how to respond to these demands from their base. It is not uncommon for either party to be trapped in a situation where the activist portion of their base is calling for something more extreme than the establishment portions of the party are willing to get behind. By and large, elected Democrats in Congress are not in favor of the concept of defunding the police. They say they're actually attempting to rewrite a little bit of what that means. We've heard some Democrats say when they hear defund, they hear reform, and that they think that the real intention here is to change the way the police interact with the communities that they serve.
Yeah. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are also hearing more about the coronavirus. Today, the largest union of registered nurses in the country is testifying to the House Oversight and Reform Committee about the need for more personal protective equipment for medical workers. Joining us now is Zini Cortez. She is the president of National Nurses United. She's also a nurse at Kaiser Permanente, South San Francisco's medical center. And Zini, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So we had you on the show back in April talking about this very topic, a lack of adequate protections for nurses. Have conditions improved in any way?
Well, I'm sorry to say that it has not improved. And I think we are being faced with another problem because now we're being asked to reuse our N95s, also known as the respirator masks, and also whatever PPE we could reuse for the next patient and for the rest of our shift, we are being told to do so.
Wow. I mean, this probably will be a huge topic today as lawmakers on Capitol Hill hear more about concerns. We know that House Democrats included a section in their last stimulus package to ramp up more PPE production through the Defense Production Act, but the Senate has not taken this up yet, and this measure is not at this point expected to pass. What are you asking Congress to do to address these concerns?
Well, we have been asking the president to fully invoke the Defense Production Act. There are too many Americans who are out of work, and that if the industries and the factories can be mandated to produce N95s and also other PPEs that are needed to fight the coronavirus, then it would be good all the way around because people would have jobs. The frontline workers will be protected, and we will be preventing unnecessary deaths, and we will be protecting the public as well. It will do a lot of good for a lot of people.
What else are nurses worried about at this stage of the pandemic? I mean, I'm asking this with the realization, as I hear you speak, that we were having almost an identical conversation a few months ago.
Yes, that's true. And with the country reopening, we would see a surge of patients, you know, contracting the virus, because right now we do not have strict guidance on the prevention of the transmission of the disease. And people think that the pandemic is over, but it's not. It's still there. And so we're just afraid that with the influx of infected patients and with lack of PPE for us frontline workers, it would be a disaster waiting to happen.
The CDC is reporting that at least 379 healthcare workers have died of COVID-19 here in the U.S., but your colleagues actually think that number is much higher. What are you hearing?
We have found out as of June 5th that there are 914 frontline workers who have died, reported deaths that we could find through public records and internal tracking and obituaries. And out of that, 134 nurses are in that category. So it's just so concerning that all these deaths could have been prevented if only we were given the proper protective equipment to begin with. And again, with the influx, possibly the influx of patients coming in because of what's going on, reopening of the country. And also with all this protests going on, there might be an uptick of infected coronavirus patients coming in.
What is your final message to lawmakers about why it is vital to act at this moment?
Lawmakers should act now before it's too late. We are there for our patients, and Congress and lawmakers should be there for us. And all we are asking is provide us with the optimum personal protective equipment, and we will do our jobs just like what we do now. We will do it safely and with love and care.
That's Zini Cortez. She is the president of National Nurses United. Zini, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
At a recent Black Lives Matter protest in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I saw so many little kids. 4-year-old Elliot fiercely held up a Black Lives Matter sign. Here's his white dad.
I love him to pieces, and I want him to understand this stuff and fight things that he knows that aren't right.
Then there's a little black girl, Winta Amora Rogers, who's become a YouTube sensation with her furious finger-waving protest march in Merrick, New York.
No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace!
Little kids are a part of this moment, but how should parents talk to them about it? Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum is a former president of Spelman College, child psychologist, and author of books on kids and race. Dr. Tatum, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And speaking of schools, you've also written that little black kids can often be uncomfortable with hearing about racism and slavery in school. They feel singled out. They feel like victims. And white teachers are uncomfortable telling little kids the history of, you know, blacks being lynched or children bombed to death in churches. So carry that over to parents. How should parents have these conversations?
Well, part of the challenge right now is that there's so much in the news. You know, the killing of George Floyd on the screen is not something you'd want children to see, but whether parents want them to or not, they might see it inadvertently. Mm-hmm. In which case, mm-hmm. parents can have conversations with preschoolers about fairness and unfairness, you know, talking about what parents are doing to make sure that their children stay safe and to bring about positive change so that nobody experiences that again.
We're talking about black parents now. I think I want to stay there before moving to white families, but talking to little kids about how they will keep them safe. They can't always keep them safe.
If you're talking to a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old, the odds are you can keep them safe. They want to know that their parents are there to support and care for them. And 99% of the time, that is true for a preschooler because they're rarely out alone. If you're talking to an older child who is out on the streets alone, then that conversation needs to be different.
Well, let's talk about that conversation. I mean, how do you explain to a child old enough to understand what they're seeing, a black man killed by a white police officer? How do you have that conversation without making them also feel dehumanized, like their lives don't matter?
Well, that has to be part of the conversation, because when you see somebody dehumanized, as George Floyd clearly was, and when you identify with that person, that's a scary thought. So parents have to both acknowledge the anxiety, the fear, and the fact that these things have happened, and we are all working very hard to make sure they don't happen in the future.
Well, is it as blunt as people who do this kind of thing, meaning the white police officer, they're the ones that have the problem? This should not reflect at all on you or on other people of color. This doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. There's something wrong with the world.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think black parents want to affirm the humanity of their children and themselves.
And do you have to also give them hope that there is something like a protest? Some people might feel I don't know. I'm sort of guessing, aren't I, being white? But I'm wondering if people would feel that's just trying to counterbalance, you know, wipe out what's real with this fairy tale of activism and protest because we've had them for years and it hasn't changed anything. So how do you bring hope to a child?
Well, one of the things that I think of is a quote from Bryan Stevenson, head of the Equal Justice Initiative and author of the book Just Mercy. And he says, "Injustice prevails when hopelessness persists." So in order for us to see and work toward justice, we have to believe that change is possible. You know, my father was a college professor. When he wanted to earn his PhD, we were living in Florida. He couldn't go to Florida State University because of segregation. That's an example of change. This problem of institutionalized state violence against Black people is part of our past, and it is protest that will hopefully make it something that we can look back on as what used to happen and not what is still happening.
How do you navigate, as a Black or white parent of a Black child, telling them about systemic, historic racism on the part of some police without triggering a rage that could be hurtful to those young people if they assign it to all police? You want to keep them safe, but you also want him to know maybe that there is some authority that he has to respond to.
Yes, of course. I mean, parents, Black parents, often refer to what is colloquially known as, quote, the talk. And that child needs to understand when a police officer asks you a question, you must always be polite, you must always keep your hands visible so they don't think you're reaching for a weapon. And even if it feels like it's not fair, I need you to remember this so that you don't accidentally get hurt or worse yet, killed. Who wants to tell their child that someone who's supposed to help them might actually hurt them?
Can Black parents afford to tell their children when you're in trouble and you need help, there are good police, you can go to the police?
You know, we know that there are police officers who want to help people, but just as most people are good-hearted, there are people who will sometimes mean you harm.
Yeah. Staying with little kids, what should the conversation between white parents and children be?
Many white parents think that if they don't talk about race or issues of prejudice, their children won't have any. But the fact of the matter is the negative stereotypes are part of the air they're breathing. So in order to counteract that, you know, with preschoolers, you can look at books together that are featuring children of all backgrounds. But also, there can be conversations about unfairness. Racism is a kind of systemic unfairness. There's a book I've been recommending to parents who want to talk about police violence, and it's called Something Happened in Our Town. It's intended for children between the ages of 4 and 8, written by 3 psychologists with great resources in the back.
Well, you say one of the things, a white parent's conversation with a white child is talking to them about what it means to be an ally and to stand in solidarity against unfairness and on bullies across the board, but also against racism. How do you ensure, though, and actually you wrote something about this, how there was a white parent who told her 4-year-old about Rosa Parks taking her bus seat. It was his favorite story. But then a little bit later, he came to her and said, "Wait, are all white people bad?" How do you keep your child from internalizing that, same as with a Black child, internalizing it's about me, I'm bad, as opposed to feeling there's something he can do to change it, he or she?
Yes. Well, I think that what's important there is to not only talk about the things that white people have done that have injured people of color, but the white people who have worked in solidarity with people of color. White children don't want to always be portrayed as victimizers. They want to also understand that there's a role for white people to be working against victimization as allies. Yeah.
You recommend Jeanette Winter's Follow the Drinking Gourd, which highlights the role of whites in assisting people on the Underground Railroad. Well, I have all the books you recommend at hearnow.org. What about the combo platter? White parents, white family who've brought in Black children.
White parents of children of color have to get comfortable with talking to those children about the racism that they are likely to experience and may already have experienced. I'm the white parent who thinks that, you know, I just need to love my child, I don't have to talk about racism, is leaving that child quite vulnerable.
By the way, you mentioned your child came home when he was, seems like just a little beyond a toddler, and said that a friend of his told him he was black because he drank chocolate milk.
Yes. And so we had to have a conversation about that.
I should say I'm laughing about that. But of course, for a little child, maybe you're noticing for the first time, wait, what my skin's different? Why? And so that can be a terrible moment for that child. But what did you tell them?
Well, so he came home and said, Tommy says my skin is brown because I drank chocolate milk. Is that true? And I said, no, it's not true. Your skin is brown because you have something in your skin called melanin. Everybody has some. The more you have, the browner your skin is. It's actually good for you. It helps protect your skin from the sun. It happens that you're the kid at your school that has the most. He was tickled by that. And so I went to the school and asked the teacher how they were talking about difference. She said, well, you know, it really hasn't come up. But of course, it had come up. You know, there was nothing malicious about Tommy's question. He was a 3-year-old trying to figure something out. But when we are too embarrassed or reluctant to respond to the preschooler's question, we convey, you know, there's something wrong with that skin. That's why we can't talk about it. And that sets the seeds for the assumptions of supremacy. We don't want that.
Of course, obviously, Tommy had never had chocolate milk.
Apparently not enough.
If he thought that through, that 3-year-old. Dr. Beverly Tatum, child psychologist, again, we'll have her list of books at hereandnow.org. Dr. Tatum, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And by the way, one of her terrific books, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? Just terrific.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
This week, President Trump passed along the false claim that that elderly protester in Buffalo shoved to the ground by police was a member of Antifa. By all accounts, again, not true. But rumors that this anti-fascist group is infiltrating protests across the country are prompting some counter-protesters to show up with guns. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports.
Justin and his buddies look kind of like they're from a special ops team. They've got beards, they're wearing military-style vests, and carrying assault weapons. But they aren't military, and they aren't police.
I see myself as a concerned citizen who happens to be armed.
Justin and the others won't give me their last name, citing concerns over their employment and safety. At this rally in Missoula, Montana, they say they're here to keep things peaceful. Missoula hasn't seen any violence associated with a week's worth of protests.
If somebody starts acting up, 3 or 4 of us go grab them and remove them from the situation.
So you're going to grab them, and then why have the gun if you're just going to grab them?
What if they start shooting?
Then you would shoot back.
I'm not going to bring fists to a gunfight, man.
They say they want to protect demonstrators, but there's also rumors that busloads of Antifa activists are coming to incite riots in small towns and cities across the country. That's why a man named Calvin is here, holding an AR-15. He says he isn't a counter-protester.
Not racist. I have zero problem with the people protesting. I support it 100%, but I don't support my town getting burned down.
Wyoming, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and other states have seen armed people responding to Antifa rumors. But the rumors have been widely debunked. The city of Missoula tweeted this video of Missoula Police Chief Jason White.
We have no credible intelligence that that is true. We firmly believe that it has been rumor and speculation.
But the rumors are having real consequences. Some organizers have canceled protests over the presence of armed men and women. On social media, people are posting photos of vans or school buses they believe are carrying Antifa activists. Joan Donovan studies online extremism, social media, and disinformation campaigns at Harvard University.
The idea of an outside force coming in and invading your small town in particular does feel threatening.
But Donovan says Antifa doesn't operate as an organized group that can do something like that.
Antifa operates as a designation similar to the way that someone might describe themselves as a punk rocker.
Still, she says, there's been a lot of disinformation about Antifa coming out in recent days, including from the president and his attorney general.
You also have a right-wing media ecosystem that is pushing this narrative.
And on social media, Twitter has confirmed at least one white nationalist group created a fake Antifa account to spread false rumors. Activists suspect there are several more. Armed people showing up at demonstrations like the one in Missoula worry protesters like Aaron Giefer.
Just the presence of guns and people who have like military getup and camo swarming the area makes me feel unsafe. And what if somebody does shoot or one of these cars backfires and then someone starts shooting?
Few organizers and protesters have said they welcome offers of protection, but the majority are deeply skeptical. They believe the people with guns are trying to hijack the narrative, trying to make protesters appear more dangerous than they are or intimidate them from exercising their First Amendment rights. For NPR News, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Police reform will be a major issue in the upcoming presidential election, which is just 5 months away. And former presidential candidate Julian Castro has been very vocal on this issue. He made it a cornerstone of his campaign. And now presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden has tapped Castro to help shape his police reform platform. For more on this and the future of the Democratic Party, it's Julian Castro. Welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be with you.
Yes, so Joe Biden has walked a cautious line on police reform, and he said he opposes defunding police. What recommendations are you making to the Biden campaign on police reform?
Well, I think that Vice President Biden gets it. You know, when he spoke about a week ago in Philadelphia, what I was impressed with was that he made specific policy suggestions. He outlined a proposal that would include banning chokeholds, demilitarizing our police, setting a national use of force standard, and also increasing police accountability. So, you know, a lot of times politicians talk, and one of the ways that you can tell whether they're serious or not is, are they specific? And Vice President Biden was specific. He gets it. He understands the urgency of it. And, you know, I don't have any formal role in the campaign, but I'm happy to give my input and perspective.
You mentioned some of the actions that the Biden campaign wants to take on police reform. You recently voiced your support for House Democrats on the Justice and Policing Act. It goes through what it would mean for qualified immunity, a database of officer misconduct, a national use of force standard. And you gave credit to the work of Black organizers for these reforms. But some progressives say this reform bill means quailing this call to defund police. What is your response to those who want to see more specific reforms around taking away funding from police agencies?
I don't think anybody's calling for a complete end to policing in this country. If somebody thinks that that's going to happen, that one day there's never going to be a need for law enforcement, I don't think there's a single place in the world where that's the case. And I don't think that that's what people are calling for. I also think that folks have to remember everybody is playing a role in terms of creating progress. Activists have a role to play in creating progress. And oftentimes they are the ones being visionary and what seems like out there right now. Elected officials also have a role to play. And usually what they do is they translate that and they create what is effective and workable right now, and then look down the road also, and how can we get closer to that vision and that goal in a smart way? And I think what you're seeing in these last 2 weeks is all of that mashed up together, figuring it out right in the heat of all of this. And so the upshot of it is going to be we're going to make real progress for the first time probably in this country in stamping out a system that too often brutalizes, especially young Black men and young Black women. And that's a thing to celebrate.
You know, Julian, we often frame police reform as a partisan issue. But I'm wondering from you, within the Democratic Party, do you think this is an issue that could split Democratic voters? You mentioned that no one is asking to defund or dismantle police, but this messaging is out there, and many people who feel strongly about supporting police have already been vocal in saying that they have huge concerns about even taking steps to change police force agencies in a dramatic and measurable way.
Since the passing of George Floyd, since the murder of George Floyd, there's been a sea change in public opinion about how African Americans are treated by police in this country, and a willingness to make changes. And you're seeing that all across the country, from New York putting forward legislation to ban chokeholds and strangleholds, to local communities putting all sorts of measures in place on use of force and greater accountability and transparency. What that tells you is that many people who before didn't think of this as a priority, or perhaps even were not willing to consider changes, actually will consider changes and will support them. Whenever you see a whole bunch of politicians moving in one direction quickly like this, it's not in a vacuum. It means that that's what they're hearing from constituents, the emails that they're getting. It represents real change in public opinion. And so I think that this is going to be an inflection point. It's going to be different. And while we're not going to get to the point, I don't think, where we're ever going to abolish, literally abolish the police or totally defund the police, we will get to a point where we have smarter law enforcement, effective public safety that keeps people safe, but also treats everybody the same, no matter the color of your skin or, you know, what neighborhood you're growing up in.
You were the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under Obama. Ben Carson was recently on our show, and he defended Trump's actions as it relates to protests against police brutality, saying he doesn't understand why people think Trump's reaction to the protests are hateful. Your thoughts?
Donald Trump has taken every opportunity in his 3.5 years in office to fan the flames of division. He did that with a tweet about the 75-year-old elderly man suggesting that somehow he's part of a conspiracy, even though we saw what those officers did to him. And, you know, he's done that in how cavalier he's been about the life and death of George Floyd, suggesting that George Floyd would somehow be happy about unemployment figures. There's a callousness, there's a bigotry, there's a intent to divide that is part and parcel of Donald Trump's politics. Donald Trump is the biggest quote-unquote identity politician that we've had since George Wallace. And what he does is play white identity politics. You know, the events of the last 2 weeks, as tragic as the death of George Floyd was, if there's anything that comes out of that, it's that a lot of people out there, including white people that Donald Trump is trying to appeal to with these politics, they realize how off the rails this is, how bad it is for our country. And they want somebody that can actually heal, that can take us in the direction of coming together. And that's Joe Biden. And I think he's going to win in November.
Georgia held its primary, and there were long lines at polling places. People waited for hours to vote. Many polling places were closed because of the pandemic. Moving forward to the 2020 presidential election, what measures do you want to see implemented to ensure people have access to vote?
We need to make sure that states and counties are equipped to actually provide voting machines, that they have election security in place, both cybersecurity and physical security, that they provide enough information. And during this COVID-19 period, we need universal mail-in ballot. We shouldn't ask people to choose between their health and getting to exercise their right to vote. The mess that has been created over there because there weren't even voting machines in some of the precinct locations where people showed up to vote at 7 in the morning, which is unbelievable. I also find it funny how the machines that send out the notice to collect your taxes never seem to go missing or get broken down. But just about every time these voting machines somewhere go missing or get broken down, it's ridiculous.
You recently started your own PAC, the People First Future, in order to support down-ballot progressive candidates. What's your thinking behind this type of local support?
As much as we talk about the national level, and there's a lot that can be done on policing at the national level, a lot of the action happens at the local level. It's at the local level that police union contracts are negotiated, use of force, discipline, transparency, accountability. So much of that happens administratively within police departments. Policy is made by city councils, and that union contract is negotiated by city councils and signed on to. So if we can get council members, mayors, and also district attorneys that are willing to hold police officers accountable when they engage in excessive force, which usually they haven't been willing to do, we can make a big difference in this problem.
That's former presidential candidate Julian Castro. Julian, thank you so much for your time.
Great to be with you, Tanya. Thank you.
Oh, joy. There's something coming for the kids. Artemis Fowl, the popular book series, has been made into a film directed by the British great Sir Kenneth Branagh, no less. Artemis, the 12-year-old Irish genius played by Ferdia Shaw, when his widower father disappears, Artemis discovers the stories Dad's been telling him about a magical underworld of fairies are true. And one of the inhabitants of that world has kidnapped Dad. The price of his return, Artemis must find the Aculos. What the heck is that? And where is it? Well, Artemis's father has already given him a clue.
He read the same poem to me every night before bed, and every time he left. May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face.
Artemis must use all of his intelligence to save his father without giving his kidnapper the thing that might destroy the world. In short, he has to become a criminal mastermind. The film has glorious landscapes and castles in Ireland, fairies swooping down on gossamer wings, kind of like weaponized Tinkerbells. It has big screen written all over it, but because of the pandemic, it's premiering on Disney Plus this coming Friday, and we welcome now the director, Sir Kenneth Branagh. Ken, sorry, because we can see everything you put up there on what was supposed to be a big screen, now maybe smaller ones, mm-hmm. But your thoughts about getting it out?
Well, we're grateful to have an audience, and of course we conceived it on the big screen and on a large scale, because that's the scale in Owen Colfer's original books. But as we know, our world has changed, and there are families all over the world who are looking forward, I think, to have an opportunity for something new and on that scale and in their living rooms.
Yeah. And what first drew you to this story in particular?
I was on a skiing holiday with my extended family, and my two nephews, Will and Sam, 11 and 9, were reading the book and said, "You have to read it, Uncle. It's your next film." I read the book on their advice, and with all their analysis, they told me what an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old liked about these stories. And a couple of weeks later, Disney, with whom I was working on their film of Cinderella, were in touch about whether I knew about the Artemis Fowl stories and would I be interested to make a film.
And what did they tell you, by the way, about what they liked about Artemis?
They liked his naughty side. They liked his adversarial side. They liked him taking on the fairies. They liked his cleverness. They liked his arrogance, if you like. Owen Colfer, the author of the books, described the idea as putting an 11-year-old Bond villain into an action movie. And the first one he described as Die Hard with fairies. It's a siege film that goes, like the clappers. One of the things we tried to do in this origin story was actually introduce him as somebody with whom people could identify. But then once he discovers, if you can believe this, that fairies are real, that knowledge brings with it the possible choice of becoming the youngest criminal mastermind you might come across.
I just want to correct one thing you said, Ken, because we have a lot of little ears. When you say, if you believe the fairies, well, of course we do.
The truth is, I was brought up in Ireland, and the legends of the little people, of trolls, of leprechauns, of pixies, were part of what we grew up to hear of, and yes, absolutely believe.
Well, we were just in Iceland, and they still believe, and adults do as well. They won't build a road through a huge boulder because they believe that the elves and the fairies might live in there.
Well, you can't suddenly give them a new place to live without permission.
Exactly.
So that's I'm with the Icelanders on this.
Can you talk a little bit more about the look of the film as director? You talk about growing up in Ireland, these vast green, you know, landscapes, crumbled castles. Talk a little bit about how it looks.
Well, the Irish seem to me to have one foot in history at all times, and they love their nation and they love their greenery. You fly over Ireland, it really is a colour green, the grass that is of an intensity that it's hard to find anywhere else in the world. And combine that with sort of rugged coastline and you have a great epic landscape. Inside that, you have a nation of poets and philosophers and artists, painters, thinkers. And in the kind of home we envisioned for Artemis Fowl was the home of a curious family over traditions, books, artifacts, ways of looking at the world, ways to acquire knowledge, Phil Fowl Manor.
From Ireland to London and then your career with the Royal Shakespeare Company, you've done acclaimed productions of Henry V, Much Ado About Nothing, you know. But for those who might say, but really from Shakespeare to a kid's movie, your thoughts?
There's no real divide between what people might like to think of as high art and low art. It's only good art or bad art. It's only good entertainment or bad entertainment. I came to this book with a rigorous examination by an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. I can't think of two people snappier or smarter, and I'd be insulting them and any other audience if I was taking Artemis Fowl any less seriously than I would Much Ado About Nothing. Shakespeare himself, by the time he finished his life's work and finished with four plays, his Farewell to the Theatre included, The Tempest, they were called the Romances, and they were written in the form of fairy tales. He uses magic throughout so that a master of dramatic art should end up in a form that some people might demean, suggesting it is simplistic, was not something he agreed with. That was a way to tell stories at a profound level through the much more difficult to achieve simplicity that such stories demanded. He does it. And I think Owen Colfer, in his very different way, does something beautiful and simple with Artemis Fowl.
Sir Kenneth Branagh, his new film about 12-year-old criminal mastermind Artemis Fowl, will be streamed on Disney Plus starting Friday. Sir Kenneth, I'm saluting. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Dame Robin, thank you very much.
I wish.
It's only a question of time.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Sweet.